Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with troubling questions raised in investigative reports by the BBC that, in spite of Trump's talk of bombing the bleep out of ISIS and General Mattis's promise to annihilate ISIS, it seems that some kind of deal was made to allow ISIS fighters to escape from Raqqa. And according to truck drivers who ferried the terrorists to safety, there were huge numbers of foreign fighters among the evacuated ISIS survivors who will likely go on to cause mayhem in the West. Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, whose latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government, joins us. We will discuss his article at the Washington Monthly, The Trump Scandal That Democrats Aren't Talking About, Did ISIS Escape Raqqa with Trump's Connivance, and try to understand how the world's most dangerous jihadists were allowed to live to fight another day, and whether there will be an inquiry into what happened, given how much time, money, and attention was devoted to the phony Benghazi story that pales in comparison. Then we'll examine the Trump administration's reversal of an Obama-era ban on the importation of elephant trophies from big game hunting, which was a result of a suit by Safari Club International and the NRA to block Obama's 2014 ban. George Wittemeyer, a professor in Colorado State University's Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation Biology, who was the chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board of Save the Elephants in Africa, joins us to discuss the rapidly diminishing populations of African elephants who have been listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act since 1978. Then, finally, we will speak with The Guardian's former Moscow bureau chief, who was expelled from the country by the Kremlin, about his new book just out, Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. Luke Harding, who knows Julian Assange and Edward Snowden well, and has interviewed the author of the Steele dossier, Christopher Steele, joins us to discuss why Steele believes his dossier on Trump's collusion with the Russians is between 70 and 90% accurate, and why Steele feels he will be vindicated as the special counsel's investigation digs deeper into Trump and his family and associates' contacts and collusion with Russians close to Putin. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at the Washington Monthly, The Trump Scandal That Democrats Aren't Talking About, Did ISIS Escape Raqqa with Trump's Connivance? Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here.
And Mike, there is some confusion about this story, and obviously the BBC's been doing an investigation into it. But unfortunately, I don't know that anybody much in the U.S. media has been onto this story. I recall that the convoy of ISIS fighters was shattered by the U.S. And that at some point or other, they did bomb it. But on the other hand, the truck drivers who ferried them out, these fighters out, said that there were an awful lot of foreign fighters amongst them. They were able to bring not just their families, but lots and lots of military hardware and ammunition with them. And that they kind of escaped, they went into Turkey or somewhere. So fill us in on what you know happened there and why this is a story that both the press and the Democrats should be picking up on.
Well, to emphasize, we've heard about how Trump was going to bomb the expletive deleted out of ISIS. Mattis said they would annihilate them. It's well known that if they're like an antibiotic resistant germ, if you don't get them all, they're going to spread. And yet somehow, according to the BBC, the United States, Britain, and the other coalition partners acquiesced in this deal that would, and I need to emphasize this, these people were not supposed to allow foreign fighters out of it, just Syrian fighters, but according to the truck drivers, there were Europeans, there were Chinese, there were from all over the place, and they were supposedly allowed to take their family members. But there was such a suspiciously high proportion of so-called family members to fighters that one has to wonder how many of them were actually hostages. Now, the Jerusalem Post has reported that some of those were ISIS's sex slaves. So there's all kinds of things involved. Yes, they were allowed to take out small arms, but they were allowed also to take out so much ammunition that one truck driver complained the weight of the ammunition broke the axle of his truck. So this one, given the fact that it's been a month and we haven't heard anything about it in the U.S. media, let alone from the administration, is very troubling.
But where did these people, where were they dropped off? And where did they, why were they allowed to sort of melt back? I believe they melted back across the border into Turkey.
Where they went is anyone's guess. Some of them did, according to the Turks themselves, did get into Turkey. As for the rest of them, they might be working their way back to France or Britain or who knows where. And it's important to point out, I'm not insensitive to the humanitarian aspects. How much would you bomb Raqqa? How many civilians would you potentially kill? But didn't the administration and didn't James Mattis, who's an experienced ex-general, didn't they know this going in? Didn't they know this was a possibility? Why did they set us up for the belief that ISIS would be annihilated? Why did they withhold the information that this had occurred? Perhaps there's a perfectly good explanation if they did a cost-benefit analysis, but I would really like to see the relevant administration official testify under oath to a congressional committee on that. What are the rationales for this?
Right, but who made the deal, and who was the, I mean, who was the deal made with? In other words, did the U.S. participate in negotiating this deal? I assume it was made with Assad's government and, by extension, the Russians and the Iranians and Hezbollah. But who was negotiating on the other side?
Well, supposedly it was between ISIS and the Syrian Democratic Forces, the sort of anti-Assad but also anti-ISIS indigenous group that we have sponsored. Now, since we sponsored them, and because the BBC said we more or less agreed or at least acquiesced to this, we were involved. So I look at this as our agreeing to this. Now, we've heard just in the last 12 hours or so from Reuters that the French are now saying, oh, we didn't agree to this. I'd like to hear what the American excuse is.
Well, it's hard to understand that these people who are so determined, these jihadists, and who have already demonstrated that they want to return home and kill as many people within their home countries as possible, their former countries as possible, that the U.S. would or anybody would allow them to basically get safe passage and then be able to sort of melt into the underground and end up blowing up people in Paris and London, etc. So that to me, ought to be, you know, that ought to, if that's what we're talking about here, if you say the French are not happy about it, well, a lot of these, apparently, these foreign fighters, according to the truck drivers, were French. So I don't understand how this could have happened and why there isn't an inquiry. I guess that's what you're calling for, right?
Absolutely. And my suspicion is the United States government did not just acquiesce in what Syrian defense forces, democratic forces on the ground agreed to. Mm-hmm. This may have been a part of a bigger deal with these satrapies in the Gulf, these Sunni tyrannies like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and so forth, that so hate Iran that they keep ISIS, who are Shia, hating Sunni extremists, around as an asset. We know that Saudi Arabia has had many connections, financial and logistic, to setting up these types of extremist Sunni terrorist groups. And we also know how acquiescent Trump is to the whole Saudi operation. When he was on his trip there, he praised them lavishly. By coincidence, in the last few years, the Saudis have bought many Trump properties or invested in them. So he has a personal financial interest in that. And, of course, his cabinet secretaries, Rex Tillerson and Wilbur Ross, were doing a ridiculous sword dance at some Saudi confab, which I think might have been a little beneath the dignity of a cabinet officer, but they had to put on a show for their hosts.
Well, it's all very mysterious. And as you say, there's a great need for a investigation, largely because the Trump people said they were going to do it better than the Obama people. And if they let these guys go and made some kind of deal with the Saudis or whoever they made the deal with, that's going to come back to haunt them, and they ought to be held accountable, surely. I mean, there was no there with Benghazi, and they wasted millions on that, and they're still going on about it on Fox News. So.
Right. And most Americans aren't even aware of this one. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it bears emphasis that there is a humanitarian issue to be made regarding civilians, but we don't know what sort of cost-benefit trade-off was made, and we need to hear that. Right. And in any case, I'm not convinced that the Trump administration is terribly concerned about civilian casualties. They widened the criteria by which drone strikes could be made despite collateral damage. As an example taken from elsewhere in the government, Trump appointed through Pruitt, the EPA head, as head of the Science Advisory Board, someone named Michael Honeycutt, who thinks poisoning by mercury is overblown, even though it's been known to be a powerful neurotoxin since the 19th century.
Well, we could spend the rest of the night talking about all these hideous appointments and how they're all.
But the point is, they don't really care about the health and safety of people.
Right.
We've seen that with another one of their science advisors thinks, quote, clean air is a little too clean for optimum health.
Well, Mike, I'm afraid we've run out of time here today, but I want to stay in touch with you and see what happens with this story and whether the BBC report is picked up by some of the investigative people over here. I thank you for joining us.
Thanks, and it's good to be here.
Thank you. And again, I'm speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government. And he has an article at The Washington Monthly, The Trump Scandal That Democrats Aren't Talking About. Did ISIS Escape Raqqa with Trump's Connivance? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Trump's reversal of a ban on trophy hunting elephants. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is George Wittemeyer, who is a professor in the Colorado State University Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology in the Warner College of Natural Resources. And he's also the chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board to Save the Elephants in Africa. He has gained global media attention in recent years and is recognized by the international wildlife community for his in-depth elephant research and scientific documentation on the effects of poaching on elephant populations. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Wittemeyer.
Thank you.
And we learned today that the Trump administration is going to reverse the Obama-era ban on the importation of elephant trophies from Zimbabwe and Zambia. And we didn't learn about this in any kind of official government release, but from the Safari Club International, which is a trophy-hunting advocacy group, who, along with the National Rifle Association, back in 2014, sued to block the ban by the Obama administration, which has just been lifted.
Yes, that's correct. That's the news that came out today.
Well, that's really bad news for the elephants, isn't it? I mean, they're already endangered. They've been on the endangered species list under the Endangered Species Act since 1978. How can this be justified?
Well, the Endangered Species Act, you can have listed species where you can legally hunt them. And the rationale for this is that typically hunting may be the only revenue source related to that species and the only revenue source by which it can be conserved. So there's quite a few endangered species that are hunted, and it's to the point that the IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, has put out sort of stipulations and guidelines on how we can do sustainable harvest of animals that are in relatively low abundance. So this has been going on as part of management for the last 100 years. And I guess there's different opinions on if hunting is ethically acceptable or not, but what we do know is that when hunting is carried out on a science-based manner, it can be done sustainably, even when you're dealing with endangered species.
Well, but what was the purpose of the ban then under the Obama administration? I mean, it doesn't sound like the ability or the permission to kill elephants is necessarily being conducted in a responsible way.
Well, so there's two sides to the story with elephants in relation to hunting, and often they get conflated. The big challenge elephants face is commercial ivory harvesting, and this is illegal. It's banned. International trade on ivory is banned. They have experimented with one-off sales that are highly controlled. But broadly, ivory consumption is banned. What we've been seeing in the last decade or maybe 5 years is several countries putting in domestic ivory regulations to try to stop the domestic trade in ivory that goes on in countries. Often what we see is ivory is trafficked illegally internationally, gets into a country, and then can be sold legally. And so, you know, once the ivory's arrived, it can be sold legally, and that's going to be a big loophole and a big problem. So we've seen a lot of countries trying to address that issue. That's the real conservation concern, this commercial trade in ivory. The hunting tends to be a much more specialized, high-value, high-expenditure activity done in limited areas. And so Zimbabwe, the original ban on hunting in 2014 was because Zimbabwe had failed to do adequate census. They had failed to provide the broader community with information on the status of their elephant populations. And without that information, it's hard to assess the efficacy of their management programs if the hunting they're doing of a listed species is appropriate and is working for the management of that species and the conservation of that species. And without that information, with what we knew was going on continentally for the species, the administration chose to ban all importation of hunting trophies. Since that time, information has essentially that put a lot of pressure on the Zimbabwean government to provide information on the status of their species. And what Zimbabwe did is they responded by allowing surveys to be done, aerial surveys to be done by scientific groups to assess the status of the Zimbabwean elephant population. And what came out from those surveys, and somewhat to the surprise of many people, was that the Zimbabwe's elephants had done quite well through a poaching epoch that had absolutely decimated populations in other countries. And Zimbabwe, there were the populations in northern Zimbabwe had suffered. There had been poaching issues there. There had been declines in those areas. But the core populations, the majority of Zimbabwe's elephant populations, fared very well. And as a matter of fact, Zimbabwe now holds the second largest number of African elephants of any country, second to Botswana. So they have actually allowed independent sources to verify the status of their populations. That verification came back that those populations were doing quite well. And I think at this point, I'm not sure the exact numbers, but I think Zimbabwe holds something like 60 to 70,000 elephants. And I believe what they've been doing for the last decade or so is trying to sell trophies for around for several hundred a year, elephants a year. I'm not sure exactly the numbers, but the assessment from my understanding is the assessment from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was that they had now provided the information needed, and that the ban of the trophies was no longer necessary.
Well, isn't there a kind of cozy relationship between the Safari Club International and the Interior Department led by Secretary Ryan Zinke, who's a really avid big game hunter?
I'm certain there is, especially under this administration, this current leadership. And you know, Safari Club International has done a number of sort of publicity activities that have been quite controversial. Personally, I'm not sure that it's really in the benefit of the discussions we have around hunting to have sort of these controversial events that they've hosted. And I think the biggest one they did is they did an auction for a black rhino, a legally hunted black rhino, and they but they, you know, did it in a sort of high publicity way in a manner that I don't think was really beneficial to sort of the public discourse and the public perception of trophy hunting. And so there's times when there's been activities that maybe aren't in their best interest or what I would think wouldn't be in their best interest. But, you know, so I think that if you look at the stipulations of Safari Club International, their ideology is that you can use sustainable science-based hunting to conserve populations, and that certainly is the case. We have a number of different examples of where there has been success, hunting-driven economic benefits that have led to a much better conservation action and much better management of a species, and help in keeping species that are under threat persisting in places that may not have allocated the resources or the effort to protect those species. So without a doubt, hunting can play a very critical role in species conservation. If you're ascribed to the politics of Safari Club International or the methods, those are up to debate, certainly. But I think the ethos of fair chase, ethical hunting, we've seen it as it's borne out, can be beneficial.
Well, we've certainly seen pictures of Donald Trump's sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, in 2012 holding the tail of an elephant that he'd shot and killed. Trump Jr. had shot and killed in Africa. And if there's a benefit, as you say there is, what is the psychology? Why do people need to shoot these majestic animals?
I don't know that I'm the best person to answer that. There's a variety of opinions about the different relationship between humans and wildlife, and some people, I think trophy hunters in particular, have a great reverence for wildlife. The way they carry out their interactions obviously are unacceptable to some groups of people. The trophy hunting bodies would argue that they've put more money into conservation than probably any other group globally, and I think that argument's borne out by when we look at the money. And so this is part of our toolbox. The trick we're dealing with here is we have enormous challenges. We're rapidly losing wild places. There's a lot of pressures on these populations, and frankly, we don't have the economic basis to conserve all the lands we need to. And so in my perspective, we're always looking for solutions and approaches that that can be implemented successfully and sustainably, and can help us protect more land and more areas. And hunting has been one of those tools.
Well, in 2016, the Great Elephant Census was done across 18 African countries. And from 2007 to 2014, the population of elephants dropped by 30%, about 144,000 animals. And in Zimbabwe, it fell 6%. So I'd still have a hard time getting my head around the idea that shooting elephants is good for elephants. So what's causing this drop then? I mean, you say running out of land, poaching, of course, is another aspect of it. But isn't the trend really alarming in the broader sense?
Oh, definitely. We're seeing really difficult challenges for elephants across these areas. The Zimbabwe story is a complex one. It's obviously a complex question. What's going on there today politically with the military coup, we can't tell what's going to come. The status of elephants is very troubling. But in terms of the perspective broadly on the continent, what we've seen in several of the core populations in Zimbabwe, the biggest populations they have, is a success story, and those populations have stayed stable or increased over the last decade to 15 years, and in a period when there's been a lot of pressure. But we've also seen in Zimbabwe areas that have suffered from illegal poaching, and some of those areas have been hunting areas, and so it's clear there's been corruption in their hunting system. There's been something going on the ground in some of those areas that has led to the removal of several thousand elephants. On the other hand, we also have hunting areas in Zimbabwe that have shown increases during this period. And so it's not a simple story in Zimbabwe about the status of elephants. And what we're seeing in general is that country has done relatively well compared to some of these other countries. The reality with Zimbabwe is it's politically as dysfunctional as the most dysfunctional countries out there. And somehow through this period of very poor governance, very complicated political scenarios, when often you can see rapid removal of natural resources with very little oversight. What we've seen in the story of elephants in that country has been a relative success of a stability in their elephant populations. Mm-hmm. And the thought is that a lot of that success is owed to a very dedicated conservation body, local bodies working in that area to support both government and non-government conservation entities, and a lot of those have ties to the hunting industry. And so this is a case where hunting, I don't know the details of it, but I would guess that hunting has played a pretty critical role in protecting elephants in that country over this period. It's been a really challenging time for the species, and that has been generally a period of decline for the species across its range.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, George Whittemeyer.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you for having me and appreciate the questions.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with George Whittemeyer, who's a professor in the Colorado State University Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation Biology in the Warner College of Natural Resources. And he's also the chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board of Save the Elephants in Africa. He's gained global media attention in recent years and is recognized by the international wildlife community for his in-depth elephant research and scientific documentation on the effects of poaching on elephant populations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of a new book that supports the revelations in the Steele dossier, which the author claims is between 70 and 90% true. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Luke Harding, who's a journalist, writer, and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy, and The Liar, The Fall of Jonathan Aitken. Two have been made into Hollywood movies, and his latest book just out is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luke Harding.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, your book is certainly welcome, particularly for me, because I get so much hate mail from the left saying that, you know, criticizing Putin and tying the Trump campaign to Putin is the reincarnation of the Cold Warrior, and where's the proof, where's the evidence? And then, so you have denial on the left with The Nation, for example, apologists for Putin, and then on the right you've got all these former Cold Warriors and Red Scare mongers now making excuses for Putin. So it's a peculiar political landscape, wouldn't you admit?
Well, I mean, I think it is. I mean, what I've tried to do in this book was to be basically empirical and to set what happened in 2016 in the U.S., where the Kremlin hacked the election in a kind of broader context and really a tradition of espionage stretching back to the Soviet Union in the days of the Cold War. I mean, there's nothing kind of sort of invented or political about that. I mean, it really is a fact. And I think to understand what's been happening, you need to look at kind of classic KGB tricks, techniques, protocols of subversion, of influence, of what Russian spies used to call active measures. Because really what's been happening, I think, is this stuff, which Vladimir Putin himself learned about at spy school in the 1970s, but just updated for the age of Facebook and Twitter.
But it also seems to be a lot to do with Putin himself, doesn't it, in the sense that he seems to be obsessed with tearing down America, but not necessarily building up Russia. And indeed, him and the Siloviki are looting Russia. So is this Cold War KGB notion of Glavny Protivnik, the main enemy, is that how Putin's worldview is framed?
Yeah, I spent, as you said in your introduction, I spent 4 years in Moscow as the kind of guardian bureau chief between 2007 and 2011. And I think one of the sort of striking features about that was how much of the kind of methodology of the Cold War was back with Putin in charge. I mean, he was sort of prime minister for some of the time that I was there. And then, of course, has become kind of president again and has basically been running Russia for 17 years. And his worldview is unambiguously that of someone who kind of grew up in the Cold War, in the Soviet Union. He believes essentially that Russia is surrounded by hostile enemies in the West, and NATO in particular. He does genuinely believe that the United States is seeking to actively overthrow him. And it's a kind of paranoid and conspiratorial worldview where whenever, for example, there's an anti-government demonstration in Moscow, of the kind I used to cover all the time when I was a reporter there, he sort of believes, or he chooses to believe, that this is the work of the CIA, that these are not actually ordinary citizens who are fed up with corruption in Russia or misgovernment, that this is part of a kind of plot against him. And I think in part that explains what happened last year. And for him, Putin wasn't doing anything especially aggressive. He was merely repaying the United States what he thinks the U.S. has done to Russia over a very long period.
So my expectation is that things are not going to get better. They're actually going to get worse because he's running for president again. And up until March, there won't be any change. There won't be any change for the better, certainly, because he'll be running against the United States, won't he?
Well, I mean, the thing is, what you have to understand about kind of contemporary Russia is it's sort of, it's not a democracy. It's what you might call a kind of soft postmodern dictatorship. And the elections that take place there are essentially decorative. There's no competitive function or element. It's really state TV presenting Putin as the kind of great and wise hero. And obviously he's going to win. And there's a sort of element of kind of fake competition with other kind of characters introduced. But it's almost like kind of watching a box set where pretty much you know how the show is going to end. And I think, of course, so Putin will win again, which means he's got another 6 years in power and he can go as far as 2024. And essentially, we're looking at an epoch with Putin, not so much a kind of term. He's already been in power longer than Leonid Brezhnev. He passed that milestone a couple of weeks ago. And I think he's set to go on and on and on.
Well, let's turn to your book, Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House, which I mentioned in the opening is extremely welcome because so much hate mail says, where's the proof? Where's the proof? And I think, my God, what what more do you need? Every day another shoe drops. But my understanding is, just in terms of Putin's having this mythology as being this clever KGB spy who's running this country, that is militarily powerful, but its economy, I think, is round about Canada's GDP. But I'm not sure that reputation is entirely well earned, because I think the cleverest people in the KGB tended to be sent to London, New York, and NATO capitals, not certainly languishing in East Germany. And much of what has happened, I think, in terms of the getting involved in influencing and manipulating the American election. My understanding is that some of the more seasoned people that he's brought into his administration, like his chief of staff, Ivanov, who was a former KGB general, they cautioned him against it. And the sort of the young Turks jumped on it, the GRU and the FSB embraced it. I know there's a kind of competition between the two, which Putin encourages. But my understanding is the SVR were pretty skeptical about it, and they predicted some of the blowback. And my sense is that Putin's been too clever. I mean, this is...
Well, I mean that's a kind of... It's a sort of fascinating topic. And peering into kind of Russian elite politics and the differences or disagreements within the Kremlin is always very difficult because it's such an opaque institution. And certainly the kind of art of Kremlinology, if you like, trying to kind of interpret what's going on inside Russian power is very definitely been back. It's been back for some time. I think in some respects we now know less about the inside goings-on of the Putin regime than we did of the Soviet Union, where there were kind of clues in Pravda which told you which way the wind was blowing. But if you believe the Christopher Steele dossier, which I broadly, with some caveats, I broadly do, then yeah, there was disagreement with the Russian foreign ministry and, for example, Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak, actually saying, look, this hyper-aggressive move against the United States to interfere so blatantly in the election will backfire. And those sort of more moderate voices, if you can call them that, were overruled by Putin and a kind of hardline faction around him and by the presidential administration and who said, no, full steam ahead. So we saw these kind of disagreements. And I think the problem for Putin, Putin is actually now in a somewhat kind of paradoxical situation, because on the one hand, you might consider the fact that Trump is in power, that Hillary Clinton lost, as being really kind of arguably the kind of greatest Russian espionage operation ever, which is not to say that Trump owes his place in the White House solely to Putin. Of course not. I mean, millions of people voted for him. But undoubtedly, the emails hacked by the Kremlin and distributed via WikiLeaks helped Trump and hurt Hillary. So, I mean, that's all kind of great. But on the other hand, Putin's primary goal, I think, was to get the U.S. to lift sanctions, and they very much hoped that Donald Trump would do that. But what the Kremlin isn't so good at is it's not very good at understanding American institutional politics. And the problem is this scandal, whether you call it Russiagate or Kremlingate or whatever, has grown so enormous that it's now impossible for Trump domestically to lift sanctions, even though I think he would very much like to do so.
So, but is there a default position in as much as the assumption is that he hated Hillary and wanted to hurt her, but he was a realist like everybody over here, for example, thought she was going to win. So why did he think Trump was going to win? Or is Trump's victory a bonus? Or is the real bonus at the end of the day just that this whole situation is weakening in America?
Well, I think Putin was generally surprised that Trump won. I think the game plan was to damage and kind of blow the legs off Hillary, if you like. They thought that Hillary would win, but she would be a weakened president. And actually, the strategy, the hashtags that the kind of Kremlin trolls had prepared was to suggest that Hillary had cheated, that the election wasn't fair, that it was illegitimate in some way. And of course, that plan was hastily abandoned when Trump crept across the line and won despite losing the popular vote. So I don't think they counted on Trump winning, and it presented all sorts of opportunities for them. Trump is still very nice about Putin. Most recently we've seen that on his Asian tour extraordinarily, but the sanctions are kind of still in place, and I think we'll be there for some time.
And again, I'm speaking with Luke Harding, who's a journalist, writer, and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, WikiLeaks Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy, and The Liar, The Fall of Jonathan Aitken. Two have been made into Hollywood movies, and his latest book just out is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. So let's turn then to one of the main characters in your book, and that, of course, is Christopher Steele, who you met with. I know that all of the committees are looking into this, both at the House, Senate, and Mueller. I don't know whether or not Mueller's met with him or not. I know Comey met with him. So walk us through that process, starting with John McCain and then his emissary to the UK, and how Comey got involved.
Well, I mean, some of this is known. Some of this is new, kind of, that I've kind of pieced together from having talked to friends of Steele. Essentially, I met him in December 2016 before the dossier came out. He didn't say anything about the dossier, although I had kind of heard rumors of his existence and some of his kind of allegations. And when BuzzFeed published the dossier in January, and it was said that it had been authored by a former British intelligence officer, it seemed pretty clear that it was going to be Steele, and his identity was kind of confirmed a couple of days later. And I mean, essentially, what was happening was, I think that there were two streams of information which were going to the FBI in 2016 about contacts between people in the Trump camp and Russians. One stream was Steele, who was commissioned by Fusion GPS to kind of investigate, had no idea who the client was, but sent out his query to sources that he'd used in the past and whom he thought were credible and had a good kind of reporting track record. Now, they came back to him and were saying hair-raising things. They were saying that there were meetings going on, that there was kind of coordination, that the Trump team essentially knew, not only knew about kind of the Hillary's emails being hacked or the Democratic Party emails being hacked, but had secretly kind of co-paid for this operation. So that was one stream of alarming intelligence, which was going to the FBI, certainly from the summer of 2016 onwards. And meanwhile, I think what's kind of fascinating about this story was that European spy agencies, the British eavesdropping centre GCHQ, but also, I'm told, the French and the Germans were also picking up some very unusual things, that they routinely monitor Russian intelligence officers. And they found these people meeting with Trump people. And this information was also kind of fed back to the CIA. And so what I was told is that the American intelligence community was slow in getting their heads around this. Asleep, almost, was the word that I was told. And so we had the explosion of these Democratic Party emails, but actually the more sensational and alarming stuff was all about Trump and who his people were meeting. And then eventually, if you kind of fast forward, the dossier ends up being given to Senator McCain in November of last year via essentially a kind of intermediary, a kind of former British ambassador to Russia. And then McCain, in turn, seeks a meeting with James Comey. But what you have to bear in mind is that, of course, Comey had been aware of these allegations and had actually been, you know, begun an interagency investigation in summer of last year. But, of course, by this point, it's too late and Trump is president.
Right, but didn't Steele himself get impatient that he felt Comey wasn't doing anything with it? My sense is that it is pretty hard to get your head around why Obama didn't make more of an issue of it. And Hillary Clinton herself apparently believes that she was let down by her own people, that had she learned about the full scope of Russian active measures against her, she would have gone public and raised hell.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's right. That's right. I mean, my understanding is that Steele was really kind of sort of frustrated because he was engaging with the FBI and that they were reading copies of his memos, and they said, well, look, we can't possibly interfere because this concerns a presidential candidate. And I think, you know, I'm told that the relationship between Steele and the FBI essentially broke down when Comey announced 10 days before polling day that he was reinvestigating Hillary's emails. Because, you know, of course this was affecting one presidential candidate and not the other. And I've also talked to sort of senior people inside the Obama administration who kind of went through a period of soul-searching, that they could have done more. And they didn't, I think largely because they thought that Hillary would win and that Trump would absolutely be enraged and try and kind of exploit this to his advantage if the Obama administration had complained, you know, and cried foul over Russia.
Well, that goes back to your point earlier, though, that the Kremlin didn't expect him to win, but they wanted to make life miserable for her. And I imagine Trump would have spent the next 4 years of an Hillary presidency running around the country saying, lock her up, lock her up.
And also saying that the election was stolen from him.
Yeah, exactly.
That Hillary had cheated, that she wasn't legitimate, that she was fake and so on and so on and so on. And so that this is the scenario they were trying to avoid. And meanwhile, of course, Trump crept across the line.
Mm. But what's the sense then of who this man Steele is? Obviously, inside the Fox, Breitbart, Sinclair bubble, they're trying to discredit him, and so are the Republicans. Grassley and others are conspicuously trying to smear him and talk about this uranium deal with a Canadian company being bought by Russians. And there's no there, but they're going to beat the hell out of that story. So what's the real story? Since you did spend some time with Steele, my understanding was he was always considered a fairly decent and respected MI6 officer with a pretty good record in terms of...
Well, that's right. I mean, you have to bear in mind that both as a kind of British intelligence officer and kind of in private business, he's been dealing with the Soviet Union and Russia for 30 years. I mean, it's a specialism. He's got plenty of sources there. And from people I've spoken to in London and elsewhere, he's broadly regarded as being credible, professional, and thorough, and also more to the point, not someone who kind of enjoys the limelight. I mean, I think this is the last. I mean, I can't speak for him, but I think the last year has, you know, I mean, it's not been an especially pleasurable experience. I mean, if you do this kind of work, you do it essentially in secret, and he doesn't talk about his clients, he doesn't talk about his sources, and he doesn't make a noise, and so I think the Republican campaign against him is, I find it slightly kind of baffling, because the thing is, actually, they haven't made any attempt to sort of try and verify or kind of disprove the dossier. They merely sort of say that it's discredited, as if by repeating it makes that so. But the problem is, the more we learn, as you were talking about shoes dropping earlier on, the more we realize that basically Steele was broadly right, that there was collusion. We keep learning of more and more meetings. We discovered days ago that Donald Trump Jr. had an energetic correspondence via Twitter with Julian Assange, who has, I mean, I know Julian, I've written a book on him, and I mean, we fell out, or at least he fell out with Guardian some time ago. But really, what's happened to WikiLeaks is it's become a kind of publishing division for the Russian state. And so there are these kind of multiple points of contact. And I think Steele feels that actually he will be vindicated. And certainly the more evidence we get, the more I would agree with that assessment.
Well, the recent revelations about connections between, or correspondence between, Donald Trump Jr. and Julian Assange, what was most disturbing about those Twitter exchanges that were revealed by The Atlantic is the kind of unctuous nature of, and the kind of giddy sense that Assange has of almost being like a Rupert Murdoch, a kingmaker. Here he is offering advice.
Well, I mean, he wanted to be ambassador to Australia. Yeah, Australian
right.
ambassador to the US. That was his kind of fantasy.
Well, that is beyond a fantasy. I mean, but nevertheless, the idea that he's giving advice and that he sees himself as this powerful player on the world stage, it's pretty heady stuff, isn't it?
Well, right. Although at the same time, I mean, he's a world famous individual. He's got 4 million plus followers on Twitter, and actually, whether you like him or not, you have to acknowledge that the material that he's published, these Democratic emails, have probably changed or at least tilted the course of history. But he's not modest. Let's leave it at that.
Right. Well, but that's what's so bizarre, is that he's kind of a hero of the left, and yet he's helped the most right-wing president in American history, perhaps.
Well, I mean, I would agree with that, but I think Julian won't agree with this. But I mean, I think the problem is that he sort of sees the world through the lens of who is for him, Julian Assange, and who is against him. And of course, he hates Hillary, and he believes that she's out to get him, and therefore he likes Russia, who were also kind of seeking to destroy her. And so there's a kind of commonality there.
Well, but how much is he connected to Russia? That's a big question, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think you just have to look at what he's leaked. All of this material, if you believe U.S. intelligence, all of U.S. intelligence came from Kremlin hackers, which doesn't mean that they are sitting necessarily kind of in the headquarters of the FSB in Moscow, although there may be, but they're people who probably are kind of outside people who are commissioned or paid to do this stuff. So there's a degree of plausible deniability there. But clearly, I mean, if you read the report released by the Obama administration in its kind of twilight hours, that they think strongly, they believe that the Kremlin hacked both Democratic and Republican Party emails, but they only leaked the Democratic Party emails, so it was politically done. And I think the way that Julian could restore his credibility is by releasing material damaging to the Kremlin, perhaps from inside the FSB or the GRU, the two main spy agencies. But of course, he never does that.
Well, your book's an extraordinary cast of characters, tying them into the Russia interference in the, I can't think of the right word, collusion, interference, whatever. I guess it remains to be proven, although Paul Manafort, Mike Flynn, Jared Kushner, George Papadopoulos, Carter Page, and then you've got these other Russian characters that you also bring into the picture, the Agalarovs and Veselnitskaya and Kislyak. Just in the last couple of minutes, you write a book about Edward Snowden. There was a peculiar connection there, and I've never quite figured out how Snowden was exfiltrated out of Hong Kong to Russia, and Julian Assange played a big role in that, and I wondered what the connection there is. Did he horn in on the Snowden thing, or was there some peculiar collusion there?
Well, I mean, that's a kind of complex question, but I think, to be clear, I don't think Edward Snowden was in any way a kind of Russian asset or a Russian spy. I mean, I think he generally was a kind of whistleblower who did what he did, whether you agree with it or not, out of a sense of kind of patriotism, and he believed the NSA, National Security Agency, had overreached itself. I also think I sit next to Ewan McCaskill, who was the journalist from The Guardian, who, together with Glenn Greenwald, met him in Hong Kong. And I think Edward Snowden thought that he would be arrested and was quite surprised that having leaked this material and done a video for The Guardian and become really very famous very quickly, that he was still free. And by this point, he was stuck. And that's when Julian got in touch and helped get him to Russia. Now, does Edward Snowden want to be in Russia? I mean, I can't speak for him, but I suspect he doesn't. But was this a Kremlin plot from the very beginning? I don't think it was. I don't think it was. And I also think that the stuff that Snowden has said and tweeted recently shows that he's still a kind of autonomous player, which doesn't mean that other people won't try and exploit him for their own purposes.
Sure. Well, I thank you for joining us. I really appreciate your book. It's extremely important and extremely timely. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Luke Harding, who's a journalist, writer, and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy, and The Liar, The Fall of Jonathan Aitken. Two have been made into Hollywood movies, and his latest book just out is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.